Hi, I'm Kate Laycock, host of DW's weekly European news podcast, Inside Europe. Our correspondents were there when the Berlin Wall fell, when the Balkans Wars broke out, and when Britain voted to leave the European Union. Now the continent is changing again, and we're rising to the challenge with our weekly combination of expert analysis and on-the-ground reporting. Find Inside Europe wherever you get your podcasts.
Israel's security cabinet has adopted a new military plan for the Gaza Strip.
The actual ministers in the government are saying that this is a plan for permanent occupation.
I'm Carolyn Beeler. Today, that plan and objections to it. Also, more cooperation between Russia and North Korea.
What we're seeing here is proof that Russia is happy to violate sanctions and that Russia is happy to give North Korea a lifeline.
Plus, women who played cricket for Afghanistan are fighting to reform their team in exile.
I would love to have my flag in my anthem.
And Cinco de Mayo for many means tequila.
Well, you're going to go to the fields so you can see the agave.
We take you there today on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thanks for starting your week with us. Marco Werman is away. We begin today's program with Israel's new military offensive to, quote, capture Gaza, a plan the country's security cabinet has signed off on. Israeli government spokesman David Mentzer explained it to reporters today.
The plan will include, among other things, the expanding and the holding of territories, not occupation, the expanding and holding of territories, and moving the Gazan population south for its own defense.
The plan also calls for hundreds of community kitchens and food distribution sites in the territory to be shuttered and replaced with centers guarded by Israeli soldiers. That has raised alarm worldwide, given the deteriorating humanitarian situation in Gaza. Here to help us get clarity on the situation is Amir Tibone. He's an Israeli journalist who works for the newspaper Haaretz. He's also the author of a book called The Gates of Gaza. Amir, can you fill in the rest of the details about the plan that Israel's cabinet approved last night?
What you just heard from the government spokesperson is the exact opposite of what the government ministers here in Israel are telling the public in Hebrew. He speaks about temporarily holding territory, but today our finance minister, who is perhaps the most influential politician in the cabinet, said the opposite. He said that any territory that will be taken in this operation will be held indefinitely by Israel and will be occupied. He used that word occupation and said we should not fear it. So it's interesting to now hear a spokesperson for the government say in English the exact opposite. And this perhaps tells you something about the real goals of this operation.
And so which of those versions do you take as the truth?
The Hebrew one. The actual ministers in the government are saying that this is a plan for permanent occupation.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says this plan will help defeat Hamas and free the remaining hostages. What is their argument for why this will work?
There is no real argument behind this. Whether or not the plan will lead to the defeat of Hamas, I cannot say, because nobody can predict the future.
Of course.
We've been fighting Hamas for 20 months now. Maybe this is the one operation that will make the difference. I don't know. But regarding the hostages, one should listen to the families of the hostages. The families are losing sleep. They are extremely worried because we have too many examples from the past 20 months of hostages who have been killed as a result of military operations. More than 40 who were taken alive on October 7 by Hamas terrorists died in captivity. So this is not really about the hostages. This is about other ambitions, a permanent occupation of the Gaza Strip.
So it sounds like there is a lot of skepticism among the families of hostages. What do you expect this will mean for people in Gaza in the coming weeks?
The operation is meant to concentrate the 2 million people living in Gaza in an area that is something like perhaps 15% of the territory of Gaza. Make this the only area that will have humanitarian aid. And according to the senior ministers in the government, again, this is not my speculation, this is what Israel's defense minister said today, the next step is basically to cause them to immigrate out of Gaza because of the difficult conditions there.
that was stated as an explicit goal of this operation by an official on the record?
Yes, by the defense minister, not just an official. Again, there is what the people who are spinning for the government say in English, and there is what the senior members of the government tell the public in Hebrew. And today, the defense minister basically said one of the main goals of the operation is to get them to immigrate out of Gaza.
Wow. Now, to implement this plan, the Israel Defense Forces has called up tens of thousands of reservists. Where does public opinion stand on that?
We see in public opinion polls consistently that between 60 to 70% of Israelis would support an agreement to end the war in return for the release of all the hostages. Unfortunately, this majority is not well represented in the current government, which relies on the support of two far-right extremist factions in order to hold power. And these two factions demand to continue the military operation and disregard the fate of the hostages.
I want to talk about the humanitarian situation in Gaza for just a second. The plan envisions distributing humanitarian aid through private companies, including an American security contractor. That is, instead of going through a UN agency like it has previously. Do you know how that would work under this plan?
This is something that really sounds like Iraq War 2.0, to bring American security contractors to control the humanitarian aid distribution under military supervision as part of an attempt to separate the population from the terrorists. This is like a news brief from 2005, but now it's happening in Gaza. I think the more interesting question is how have Netanyahu and his right-hand man, Ron Dermer, the strategic affairs minister, convinced the skeptic Trump administration, full of people like J.D. Vance, who supposedly learned the lessons of Iraq, how were they convinced to go along with this? That's a question I haven't figured out yet.
Right. President Trump is going to be visiting the Middle East next week. Are we hearing anything or have you heard anything from the Trump administration about this plan?
So far, they seem to endorse it. And remember, the Trump administration, in a way, is speaking in two languages on this issue. Because you have people within the administration, like the vice president, like some people in the Defense Department, to some degree, Mr. Witkoff, who seem to be more in search of diplomatic solutions. But there's another wing of this administration, which is fiercely loyal to Prime Minister Netanyahu's positions. And we'll see what comes out of it. But this is a very controversial plan.
Amir Tabon is a journalist with the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, and he wrote The Gates of Gaza. He spoke with us about Israel's new plan to expand the war in Gaza. Today, more than 1 in 50 babies in the U.S. is conceived by IVF, or in vitro fertilization. Not so long ago, the procedure was controversial. Now there's research into reproductive science that may prove much more controversial. A lot of it is happening in East Asia, where birth rates are in free fall and officials are clamoring for solutions. From Bangkok, The World's Patrick Nguyen reports.
In a lab in China, scientists are impregnating monkeys. Not with embryos created naturally from a sperm and egg, but with a synthetic embryo they made themselves.
Right now, I think that we can culture the monkey embryos in vitro for up to 25 days. So it's about 3 weeks.
After 3 weeks, the monkey pregnancy fails, says Jun Wu, a prominent stem cell researcher who collaborates with these Chinese labs. He thinks eventually they will be able to bring baby monkeys to term. Wu has his own lab at UT Southwestern Medical Center in Texas, where he's making synthetic human embryos. But his research team is not trying to impregnate a person with their experiments.
In the case of human, we are not allowed to do that for ethical and technical reasons.
His synthetic embryos mimic blastocyst, a human embryo at about 6 days old. And get this, they are created from stem cells derived from the skin of a biological male. The things scientists can do in the realm of fertility and stem cells is getting more mind-blowing all the time. Perhaps most sensational are the achievements of Japanese geneticist Katsuyo Hayashi, known for creating mice with two biological dads, or moms.
They grow up, they eat the food, they mate, just like conventionally bred mice.
That's Dr. Hayashi showing off a photo of his experimental mice at a recent TED Talk.
And they can come from two fathers, two mothers, or perhaps other combinations. Thank you.
Wait, hold up. Other combinations? Yep, because this research is all about taking skin cells, then turning them into stem cells, which can grow into anything, a kidney, a sperm, an egg. So it is theoretically possible to scrape skin from a single mammal, make some cells into eggs, other cells into sperm, and create a baby with only one biological parent. The possibilities are wild.
I think the question is, how do we advance the conversation to something that's more meaningful and less polarized and kind of scary?
Megan Muncy is a stem cell biologist with the Murdoch Children's Research Institute and the University of Melbourne. She prefers to focus less on the sci-fi stuff and more on the immediate benefits of this research. For example, scientists can create a zillion synthetic human embryos and run almost any test on them they like, with few restrictions.
These models are models. They're not embryos.
That's important because real human embryos are harder to come by. And in almost every country, there are limits on what experiments you can do on them. With synthetic embryos, scientists can run many types of tests and even test drugs on them, all to solve a vexing fertility mystery. Why does IVF so often fail, forcing would-be mothers to go through round after round of expensive, exhausting treatment?
Doing this kind of research may allow us to understand why we have such high embryo loss when we try to help people have babies with IVF.
But what about in the future, trying to actually impregnate a human with a synthetic embryo, one created from a skin cell? Imagine infertile couples getting to make sperm and eggs and embryos with their own skin, or same-sex couples having biological children with both their DNA. Dr. Munsey says, as great as that sounds, experimenting with human life could create babies with painful disorders, and that's not humane.
Trying to create a pregnancy with these models, it should be banned.
In the US, UK, Australia, lots of countries, it is banned already. But stem cell research is blitzing ahead, much of it in countries such as Japan, where for every baby born, two people die. It's a national crisis. Countries like Japan, with dismal birth rates, may face more pressure to loosen rules on stem cell experimentation. Misao Fujita, a bioethicist with Kyoto University, says the time to start talking about this is now. According to Professor Fujita's research, about half of the Japanese public would accept synthetic sperm and eggs being used to create a child. That's pretty high for a procedure that's currently illegal. As for Dr. Jun Wu, the stem cell researcher in Texas, under Texas law, he can't come anywhere near human embryos.
But in China, though, it's more relaxed. So government support this line of research.
China, too, is facing population decline. Beijing can pour loads of funding and brain power at fertility research. Dr. Wu says he knows of at least 8 or 9 Chinese labs making synthetic human embryos and others running tests on monkeys. He is optimistic that one day scientists will use this technology to conceive a healthy human through synthetic sperm or eggs, a process called in vitro gametogenesis, or IVG.
Even though the ultimate goal is IVG to generate embryos, during the process, there's a lot more technologies can be developed that can benefit humankind.
Even if IVG never proves viable, Dr. Wu says if along the way his team can help IVF work better for couples, it would all be worth it. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen, Bangkok.
And now two quick election updates. The first from Romania. Far-right candidate George Simion won a decisive victory yesterday in the first round of the presidential election. The vote came 6 months after disputed election results were tossed out over alleged Russian interference and covert social media manipulation. Simion is a staunch Trump ally and now the clear favorite heading into a final vote on May 18th. And the second election update, Australia has re-elected Anthony Albanese as prime minister. He won over hardline conservative Peter Dutton, who appeared to have the upper hand as recently as a month ago. Voters saw an association between Dutton and U.S. President Trump, and that likely hurt Dutton. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Russia and North Korea have been strengthening their alliance recently. The latest evidence of that, North Korea is sending workers to Russia to bolster a shrinking workforce. That's according to The Wall Street Journal. Rachel Min-Young Lee is a senior fellow for the Stimson Center's Korea program and an expert on North Korea.
I would say that this is not a surprise given the recent trends we have seen with Russia and China failing to enforce sanctions in recent years.
UN sanctions on North Korean workers.
That is correct. And also the fact that last year when Putin visited Pyongyang for a summit with Kim Jong-un, he basically indicated that he was opposed to one-sided legal restrictions against North Korea. By that, he meant the UN sanctions.
What kind of work are these workers doing?
For Russia, we're talking about lumberjacks, we're talking about builders. North Korea has a lot of well-trained, hardworking laborers, very skilled, and they're cheap.
So I'm curious about the why here, beyond what you've just said from both the Russian point of view and the North Korean standpoint. Why does Russia need these workers, and why are North Koreans eager to take these jobs?
Well, I think from a Russian point of view, they do a lot of jobs that Russians are reluctant to do and for longer hours. And Russia has a declining population, especially in the Far East. They've always had a hard time attracting workers to that area. And especially during the wartime, a lot of men have been called to the war.
Right.
That makes everything more complicated for the Russians. So I think when an opportunity presents itself, they would be more than happy to host North Koreans. From a North Korean point of view, they've always been happy to send workers overseas for extra cash.
We have also reported on North Korean troops fighting for Russia in the war against Ukraine. Do you see that as part of this same story, part of these strengthening ties between the two countries?
I think that's your definitive proof that Kim Jong-un, at least North Korea, has something longer term in mind and not something tactical short term. I don't think that Kim Jong-un sent troops to Russia for the sole sake of earning hard currency, because we're talking about a country that's making millions of dollars per year through cyber hacking. So in a way, whatever he's making off of these soldiers is petty cash. He wouldn't mind making the extra cash on the side, but I don't think he would have gone that far if it was just for the money. What better way to prove that you're 100% into this war, that you're willing to shed blood for your friend?
Right. That's the highest form of commitment you could offer. How else are North Korea and Russia strengthening ties right now?
Well, I think we have to look at the North Korea-Russia treaty that was signed in June 2024 when Putin was in Pyongyang. If you look at the treaty, it really spans across all areas from political, diplomatic, to military, security, and cyber even, and economic trade investment. This is not just in words. We have seen the two countries really making a commitment to follow up on the treaty. If you look at the frequency and the level of exchanges between the two countries in the last couple of years, you can see an effort to institutionalize the exchange and cooperation. So I think we often talk about Russia dropping North Korea in maybe, if not immediately, slowly, once the war in Ukraine is over in some form. And I think we may have to think about that a little more. I mean, is this a short-term relationship?
So if this does become a longer-term relationship, what are the security concerns there?
Even if Russia does not actively become involved in a conflict on and around the Korean Peninsula, just the fact that there is that possibility of Russia becoming involved. And I say this because of an article in the new treaty that I talked about that was signed last year, that some would interpret as automatic military intervention if one party comes under attack. And that article, by the way, was the reason that Kim Jong-un decided to send troops, according to North Korean media.
Rachel Min-Young Lee is a senior fellow at the Stimson Center. Remember this? It is the sound Skype made while calls were being connected. Lots of that in our newsroom not too long ago. But today, it sounds like a bit of a throwback. Skype is shutting down. The tech platform launched in 2003, and it is hard to overstate how dramatically it changed communication, especially for people with friends and family scattered across the globe. Lorenzo Franceschi Bicarai is a senior writer at TechCrunch. Lorenzo, remind us how revolutionary Skype was when it first appeared back in the early 2000s.
So I remember it very well. At the time, I was living in Spain, and I came from Italy. So I had a family in Italy, friends in Italy. And, you know, at the time it was hard to communicate with them outside of sending emails or using some chat apps at the time, which were something like ICQ, MSN Messenger, or AOL in the US. And obviously you could use regular calls, but they were expensive. And so when Skype came, essentially it made video and audio calling on the internet free and available to anyone who could download this app for free. The quality was great. You don't have to pay anything. And I think it changed a lot of people's lives.
Now, of course, there are lots of alternatives. We have Zoom and FaceTime and WhatsApp. To what extent did Skype pave the way for those platforms or just the kind of idea of real-time video chatting?
Yeah, I mean, that was the basic, you know, the ability to do a video call, an audio call, and make it easy and available for everyone. That was basically, yeah, that was the main legacy. But there are some things that people don't think about that Skype was really pioneering. For example, when it launched, it claimed to have end-to-end encryption, which basically means that any call or message that went through the platform could only be seen or heard. You know, like a phone call could only be heard by the two people involved. Like Skype could not intercept it. Anyone monitoring the internet could not intercept it. And this at the time was, I mean, there's no other way to say it. It was absolutely revolutionary. At the time, any phone call could be intercepted by telecom companies. I mean, that is still the case with regular phone calls. And this created a little bit of a panic in law enforcement and intelligence circles. You know, all of a sudden, people in those circles were worried that criminals or terrorists, mobsters, you name it, would be able to communicate in private and authorities would not be able to know what they were up to.
I'm wondering if you can tell us to what extent Skype made the other platforms that came after possible.
Well, at the beginning, Skype worked with a peer-to-peer technology, which meant that essentially you were communicating with the person. You were like connecting directly to the person you were communicating with, like at an internet protocol level. And that was at the time, again, not really, it was common in terms of like downloading pirated files or, you know, not necessarily pirated files, you know, with programs like eDonkey or eMule and Kazaa and things like that. But it was not used in communications apps. But yeah, you know, again, it made phone calls and video calls really freely available for everyone. So I think probably that was, I mean, that was also the big revolution, making everything free. So all the apps coming after would not be able, you know, you couldn't get a huge customer base if you had to make them pay.
For all of its importance, Skype failed to keep up with its competitors. What happened?
It's hard to tell exactly what happened. I think in part was the fact that Skype was born as a computer app, desktop app, and perhaps it wasn't as fast as others to embrace the mobile revolution. I do remember Skype being an app on a phone, but maybe it wasn't as good as WhatsApp and Viber and other that came after. Yeah, maybe some people just got to another app and found it more useful, and Skype slowly became obsolete.
Lorenzo Franceschi Bicarai is a senior writer at TechCrunch. You're with The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Over the past few years, Afghanistan's men's cricket team has climbed the rankings in one of the world's most popular sports. The team made history in 2024 by reaching the semifinals of the T20 World Cup for the first time. But for Afghanistan's women's cricket team, the past few years have looked much different. When the Taliban regained power in 2021, women were barred from sports and the team disbanded. The athletes in exile have been fighting to play together again, though, and as the world's Bianca Hillier reports, now could be their chance.
Binafsha Hashimi never wanted to leave Afghanistan. She grew up in Kabul and was a teenager when the Taliban regained power in 2021.
I was one of the people who never wanted to leave the country, no matter what happened.
It became clear that leaving was necessary, but she had one condition.
There is something in my heart that said, don't let me go without my team.
her cricket team. Hashimi is one of 25 members of Afghanistan's national women's cricket team. It was formed in 2020, prompted by international cricket rules stating that countries had to have both a men's and a women's team. Hashimi says she couldn't have lived with herself if she evacuated and something bad happened to the girls who were left behind. So she started reaching out to folks abroad to see who could help them and their families flee. 7,000 miles away in Canberra, Australia, Catherine Ordway heard the call.
I saw the news story about how a group of Australian women were able to get the Afghan women's football team, soccer team, out of Afghanistan. And so I thought, righto, I'm going to get the cricket team out.
Ordway, who researches sports integrity at the University of Canberra, formed a small group to help with the enormous task ahead. Nearly a year full of paperwork, border crossings, and countless WhatsApp messages followed. Eventually, with emergency humanitarian visas from the Australian government in hand, the pieces fell into place.
We managed to get between 130, 140 people out,
including Banafsha Hashimi and 10 members of her family. Her father, an Afghan Special Forces soldier, was killed in Kabul. Hashimi was grateful to go somewhere safe, but she was also heartbroken and scared.
I was crying, honestly, all the way. The culture, the language, every step is different.
A lot has happened in the nearly 4 years since then. Ordway, who is still in daily contact with the Afghan women, says they've learned English, gotten jobs, driver's licenses, and started school. Some have gotten engaged and had children.
In fact, I heard there was another baby on the 19th of April, so we've got this extended family that just keeps growing. It's so fantastic.
Hashimi landed in the country's capital city, Canberra. It was tough at first, but she's come to like living in Australia.
I quite like here because of freedom and the opportunity they give women.
One opportunity Hashimi continues to fight for, though, is the chance to play cricket as part of the official Afghanistan women's national team. Since the Taliban regained power, neither Afghanistan's cricket board nor the International Cricket Council, or ICC, the sport's global governing body, have recognized the women's team. That means they don't receive any funding, they can't play in international games, and they can't wear Afghanistan's flag on their uniforms. Hashimi says to her, that would mean everything.
If I'm going to play for a national team, I would love to have my flag in my anthem.
The flag would be an important reminder that she and her teammates aren't just playing for themselves.
You will play for whole Afghanistan, so I would love to wear it.
The team has, for years, been calling on the ICC to provide support. Specifically, they asked for help setting up a refugee team based in Australia. They say they never received a reply. So this past January, they decided to play on their own terms. The Afghan cricketers reunited to play their first game since fleeing the Taliban. They played against a team from Cricket Without Borders, an organization that brings young women into the game. Hashimi served as vice captain.
That day was a special day. That was the moment that we say, okay, we will cheer up, we will go further, and we'll try to make things happen.
The game drew a lot of attention to the Afghan women, and some team members believe it put pressure on the ICC to take action. A few weeks ago, out of the blue, they did. The ICC announced a dedicated task force and fund to support the displaced cricketers.
Why would the International Cricket Council feel like they needed to consult with the people that were involved, with the Afghan women? It's entirely on brand.
Ordway says neither she nor the team members have heard additional details about how or when the ICC will help. The ICC did not reply to a request for comment for this story, but in a press release, they committed to providing the women with coaching, world-class facilities, and mentorship. Banafsha Hashimi is hopeful and hesitant.
When you really take the action, then I will really appreciate you. Without that, I'm sorry. I don't believe you guys.
Until then, Hashimi says she and her teammates continue to play cricket with local teams, training so that they're ready when the opportunity comes. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
A tense relationship between India and Pakistan is under new stress. Last week, a Pakistani cabinet minister raised concerns about intelligence suggesting that India might attack Pakistan. That's after a deadly attack in Kashmir killed 26 people, most of them Indian tourists. India blames Pakistan for the attack. Today, Iran sent its foreign minister to Islamabad to help mediate. Michael Kugelman is a South Asia analyst and columnist for Foreign Policy. He is based in Washington.
Well, what we've seen to this point is not any type of military action. What we've seen instead are some very muscular diplomatic and economic retaliations taken by India initially and reciprocated by Pakistan. And this includes essentially toning down in a big way diplomatic relations. It includes cutting down all trade relations. It includes closing the only open land border between the two countries and a series of other measures that come short of military action, which is what many had been expecting could happen from India in terms of retaliating for the attack some days ago. India is trying to send a message to Pakistan in the strongest way possible, which could entail a series of actions that go beyond military strikes.
And why does India blame Pakistan for the attack on tourists in Kashmir?
India has not provided publicly any evidence linking the attack to Pakistan. There is a history of Pakistan sponsoring violent actors, terrorist groups that operate in Kashmir and carry out attacks. And in fact, the last time we had a crisis similar to the current one, back in 2019, there was an attack on India-administered Kashmir that killed 40 Indian troops. And that was claimed right away by a group called Jaish-e-Mohammed, which is a well-known Pakistani terrorist organization. So there clearly is a historical precedent here. And Indian officials have indicated, though they have not provided conclusive proof of this, that several of the attackers are from Pakistan. And they have also indicated there are other links to Pakistan. But again, this has not, at least to this point, been brought into public light.
So we have this kind of diplomatic tit-for-tat going on. Why is Iran's top diplomat now getting involved with this?
Yeah, it's an interesting development, given that one would not have expected Iran to put itself out there as a mediator. And that's because it has fairly good ties with India and Pakistan, but not very strong ones. Whereas its neighbors, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Qatar, all have very strong relations with both India and Pakistan. And in a few cases, particularly with the UAE, the UAE has mediated Indian-Pakistan issues in the past, including something that led to a border truce between the two in 2021. Mm. I think that, you know, in this case, Iran may be looking to send a message to anyone that would want to pay attention that it can be a constructive regional actor. Hmm. And let's remember that Iran does share a very long border with Pakistan. But right. I also would note that last year, Iran staged airstrikes in Pakistan, which it said were targeting terrorists, which precipitated a brief military crisis between Iran and Pakistan. So even in this context, Iran is not always the most responsible player.
So far, the actions by these two countries have been diplomatic. There have not been military mobilizations. Based on how these two countries have interacted in the past, can you say anything at all about whether that still might be in the cards?
I definitely think there's a strong likelihood that India could respond with some type of military action. There is a precedent for that. I mean, as you know, both countries are nuclear nations. That's been the case since the late 1990s, but they have both been willing to use limited force against each other since then, including in the 2019 crisis when India retaliated to that attack in India-administered Kashmir with airstrikes in Pakistan, the first time it had done that since 1971. I think that could certainly be a possibility for India to launch some limited strikes that target terrorists' infrastructure in Pakistan. I think that you could look at the fact that both India and also Pakistan have indeed modernized their militaries significantly, and I think that that might give India pause in terms of, you know, how much scale it would be willing to deploy in a potential military action. I think it would be quite comfortable with the types of limited airstrikes and perhaps surgical strikes involving commandos, you know, quick over the border and back type operation. It's done those in the past. I think it would be comfortable with that. But beyond that, I think that New Delhi would conclude that it would need to be careful, because if Pakistan's own capacities when it comes to conventional uses of force. I also think that there's a lot of domestic political pressure here bearing on India and its government, which projects itself as very strong, nationalistic, defiant, and intent on hitting back at terrorists. Mm-hmm. So I think that if India were to not do anything at this point, especially given all the tough talk coming from New Delhi and signaling that something could be coming, for them to do nothing, I think that could actually be very politically damaging for the government.
Michael Kugelman is a South Asia analyst and columnist for Foreign Policy. He's based in Washington. Today is Cinco de Mayo, and that's a good excuse for many in the U.S. to do tequila shots or have a margarita. Good timing for a new book digging into the history of the tequila industry in Mexico. The World's Tibis Isaiah went with the author of that book to the city of Tequila in Jalisco, Mexico, to trace the roots of the iconic spirit.
South of the border, down Mexico way, that's where I fell in love.
During the dry years of the American Prohibition in the 1920s and 30s, U.S. tourists started traveling to Mexican border cities to drink legally.
My thoughts ever stray.
Places like Tijuana and Ciudad Juarez turned into nightlife hubs with casinos, bars, and cantinas, all serving tequila shots and margaritas. Up until this time, tequila was little known in the U.S. It was created by indigenous people in this area who were fermenting agave plants that grow in hot climate. And then, after the Europeans brought new distillation techniques to the New World, it became industrialized in Mexico.
We're starting to see some agave fields.
There'll be a bunch here shortly.
To understand how the tequila spirit turned into a $10 billion industry, I recently traveled to the Mexican state of Jalisco with journalist Ted Denoways. He's been to the city of Tequila dozens of times, doing research for his new book, Tequila Wars.
The thing that everyone said over and over again was, all of that history is lost. It's just gone.
For years, he looked at public records and family journals, and he found out that the tequila industry almost disappeared after the bloody Mexican Revolution. But during Prohibition times, producers started smuggling tequila bottles into the U.S.
Suddenly, there's enforcement that says, you know, this is illegal to bring in. But all that it does, of course, is that this product that's already in demand is now scarcer, and so it's now got a premium price.
That's when American consumers fell in love with tequila, and that saved the industry, he says. Now, tequila has been the fastest growing distilled spirit in the U.S. for decades, and celebrities like George Clooney, Michael Jordan, and the Kardashians have launched their own brands.
80 to 85% of all tequila is sold in the United States, more than what's sold here.
Guillermo Erickson Sousa is a descendant of one of the two oldest families of tequila producers in Jalisco.
My great-great-grandfather, we call it tatarabuelo in Español, and he started Tequila Sousa in 1873.
His family eventually sold the distillery and left for Chicago. But 20 years ago, he came back to tequila and founded a new brand called Los Abuelos.
And we're on the ranch part of the property where we grow the agave, and we have animals here. And now you can feel the heat here of our April and May.
The tequila boom attracted a lot of tourists here.
And so it's a lot of jobs. It's a lot of farm labor jobs, factory jobs, a lot of marketing jobs, distribution jobs, and it's just been crazy.
Demand for tequila is so high that it's creating problems because the supply of tequila has natural limits. For a liquor to be called tequila, it needs to be produced in a specific area, just like champagne or scotch. So a lot of producers are scrambling to secure as much land as possible in official tequila territory. And now there is an oversupply of agave, and Sousa says the demand might not be holding up in the near future.
We don't know what will happen, but the Z generation is not drinking it. Yeah, we don't know. They're more health conscious, and they're drinking about 10% of what previous generations have.
if there aren't enough distilleries to buy all this agave, the tequila starts to rot and farmers can lose everything. But for now, he says the demand remains high, with over 2,000 brands of tequila on the market. But Sauso says they're not all great.
For those of us in the business for the long haul, we like to say don't drink celebrity tequila.
He says some manufacturers take shortcuts that affect the quality of the product. For him, it's important for people to try tequila that's done right, because the best tequilas can be sipped. So I decided to give it a try and go for a good drink at Jose Cuervo's distillery. That's one of the most famous brands of tequila out there.
And now let's try.
Okay. This is an añejo.
This is an añejo.
And it's darker.
It's darker because they spend more time in the barrels.
Sonia Espinola, a distiller at Cuervo, recommends drinking tequila that's made with 100% agave. And make sure it's not mixed with other beverages or sweeteners. I asked if I should drink it with lemon and salt, but Sonia said, no way.
In the old times, they used salt and lemon, and they drink white tequila. And because it was very aguardiente, it was very strong. So one or two shots of tequila, you sink or you got married.
Now, she says, a good tequila should be so smooth that you can pair it with any food, just like wine.
When you start smelling, you have to find flowers, fruit, minerals, could be dry fruit.
To be honest, I don't think I was as good at recognizing all these flavors.
And then I smell one more time. What else you can find?
Orange?
Yes, very fruity.
But I guess some folks just need a few more sips before they can develop a mature palate. For The World, I'm Tibisa Isea, Jalisco, Mexico.
You're listening to The World. A Soviet spacecraft that launched in 1972 was expected to come crashing back down to Earth this week. It was supposed to land on Venus, but it never got there. Instead, it's been orbiting for more than 50 years. The World's Daniel Hoffman brings us the story behind this relic of the Cold War space race.
By the time the Cosmos 482 spacecraft was launched, the space race between the Soviet Union and the United States had been in full swing for about 15 years.
Russia had blasted a man-made moon into outer space. On every continent and in every land, the story of Sputnik 1 dominated the front pages.
With Sputnik 1, the Soviet Union launched the first satellite into Earth's orbit. About 4 years later, another remarkable achievement followed.
Man had his first great success in space when the Russians pushed a man across the threshold. He was Yuri Gagarin, the astronaut the Russians lionized as the first to orbit the Earth.
In the early 60s, the Soviet Union seemed to be winning the space race, up until this happened.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Anatoly Zak, a journalist and author of a book called Russia in Space, says the competition only expanded from there.
Everything was understood at that time in this context of the space race. Every time Soviet scientists had to go to the government to approve some kind of project, first sentence in their proposals was, look, the NASA and the United States are doing so and so, so we should do this as well or something similar of equal importance.
The next frontier in the early 70s for the U.S.-Soviet competition was exploring planets using unmanned spacecraft.
Both United States and Soviet Union at that time were very actively exploring the planets using the robotic probes. For example, the Americans were the first who delivered very clear images of the Martian surface. So Soviet Union focused on Venus as a sort of counterweight to the exploration of Mars.
Zak says there was a lot of prestige in space exploration, but also political pressure, and that led to many Soviet achievements, big and small.
They were first who were able to penetrate the very dense atmosphere of Venus, very hostile environment of Venus, to reach the surface and actually transmit useful data from the surface of Venus all the way back to Earth.
Achievements like that one would be covered extensively in the Soviet press.
В Советском Союзе осуществлен запуск автоматической межпланетной станции.
This Soviet documentary highlights the success of a Soviet Venus probe in 1970, which discovered numerous things about the planet's atmosphere. After that success, 2 years later, another probe, called Venera 9, was supposed to follow. But that mission ran into some problems, Russian space expert and journalist Vitaly Егоров explains.
Venera 9... Она как раз не стартовала. Верхняя ступень ракеты не отработала.
Егоров says the spacecraft successfully launched into Earth's orbit, but because of a technical problem with one of the rockets, it couldn't blast off towards Venus. That's why it's been stuck in orbit for all these years.
Советская космонавтика дала такое название «неудачной Венере», чтобы не показывать эту неудачу.
Егоров says that whenever a spacecraft wouldn't reach its destination, it would essentially be renamed. So what was supposed to become Venera 9 was called Cosmos 482 because it never made it to Venus. Егоров says the Soviet Union didn't want to publicize its failures, so it would simply rebrand and say that it successfully launched a satellite into orbit.
Постепенно, вот за полвека понижал свою орбиту, и сейчас он уже гораздо
For the past 53 years, Егоров says the spacecraft has been orbiting our planet and very gradually losing altitude. Now it's projected to make a crash landing back to Earth, likely within the next week. Anatoly Zak says predicting the timing and the location of the crash landing won't be possible until just hours before it comes pummeling down.
When you're flying with this tremendous speed, even a few seconds difference can have a huge geographical change because it affects your trajectory by hundreds of kilometers. So it's notoriously hard to predict. Of course, oceans are covering a big part of this area, so the probability is very high that it's going to end up in the ocean.
Since the early 70s, a lot has changed in the relationship between the U.S., Soviet, and now Russian space programs. Zak says that in the 70s, after years of competition, space became an area of cooperation between the Soviet Union and the United States.
Right now, we're almost like came full circle, because, of course, it's exactly the time now where we're marking almost like three decades of cooperative space program, which is now unraveling and turning back into the competition.
And that competition isn't limited to Russia and the U.S. Other countries, like China, have also entered the competition, along with many private companies that are leading the way in the new space race of the 21st century. For The World, I'm Daniel Hoffman.
If you need a space-related soundtrack as you watch for that Soviet spacecraft to land, we've got a recommendation, a track called Cumbia Espacial, aka Space Cumbia, which imagines a whole planet with that name. The song and the planet are the creations of a musician who calls himself El León Pardo, the brown lion. The coral on this planet is constantly changing color and the trees have their own language. And El León Pardo reigns here as king, ordering his listeners to dance.
Hey, olla de barro, boga de los astros, cuerpo de los ríos, idioma de los árboles, constelaciones, cardúmenes. No te abandones, sacúdete, pa' ver si tiene o no tiene chispa, el viaje de la estrella, el rayo de la misma.
Back on Earth, the musician's real name is Jorge Emilio Pardo Vázquez. He lives in Bogotá, Colombia. In addition to composing music, he also carves instruments out of wood, wooden flutes, indigenous instruments called cuisi, and they date back centuries with a sound believed to cure ailments and impart blessings. The cuisi has also been seen as a symbol of resistance to colonial rule. Cumbia Especial appears on a new album called Viaje Sideral, or Space Voyage. We leave you with another song from the album to take you on your journey. The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Have a great day and join us back here tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include the Kelsen Foundation, Roman Mars, Gavin Selmanese, LLC, the Schmidt Family Foundation, Ed and Lillian Schneider. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.
From PRX.